Why is Diane on my mind? The presence of militias at protests around the country, in Kenosha, in Portland, in Louisville. Armed civilians have shown up alongside protesters demanding action against police violence and racism. In the cases of Kenosha and Portland, clashes involving militia members led to people actually being killed. Who are these militias, and why are they there? And what do our laws say about their rights to gather and patrol these demonstrations? I asked Mary McCord, legal director at the Institute for Constitutional Advocacy and Protection and visiting professor at law at Georgetown University Law Center. Mary, if we can, let's start with a really basic question. What are militias and how do they differ from vigilantes?
So the term militia is used in the U.S. Constitution, and it's used also used in the constitutions of most states. And what it refers to is the body of able-bodied residents. Actually, in most states, it was men, not residents, at the time of those constitutions. But the body of able-bodied residents between certain ages, typically 17 and 45, that are available to be called forth or activated by the government in defense of the state. So oftentimes there's confusion because private unauthorized militias will point to that language in the Constitution and say, that's us, the able-bodied residents. But they cannot call themselves forth or activate themselves when they see fit. They would have to be called forth in the case of the U.S. by the Congress, which by the Constitution has the ability to call forth the militia, and then they would report to the commander-in-chief, the president. And in the states, it's usually the governor who has the ability to activate these able-bodied militia members. And this, of course, would be only to supplement, which in the states is the National Guard. So if the governor thought we need something more, he could activate the militia, the able-bodied citizens. Same with the U.S. We now have a standing military. We also have the ability to enable the National Guard, so it would only be used if you needed something more than that. So what that means is that because militia activity really is not authorized if it's private, it's not authorized, that means that really often is vigilantism. So when a militia says, we are going to deploy in the face of protests downtown in order to protect property, they're just being vigilantes. They have no authority to do that.
So they are acting on their own. Two or three neighbors could get together. Two or three friends could get together, pull out their guns, their long guns, and call themselves militias, or somebody else is calling them militias. Who's doing the naming here?
So you actually see both. There are a number of bodies of mostly men, but there are some women who have organized themselves, and oftentimes they call themselves militias. So for example, we have the Pennsylvania Lightfoot Militia, the New York Lightfoot Militia, the 3% People's Militia of Maryland, and I could go on and on. Others call themselves other things like the Kenosha Civil Guard, the New Mexico Civil Guard. And some, like the 3%ers, will say, we're not a militia. We're a group of patriots who are, you know, here to help augment law enforcement and do our, you know, duty to the Constitution to protect and defend the Constitution, of course, as they interpret it, not as the Supreme Court has interpreted. I think what's key when we talk about, you know, militia activity going on in the U.S., which we're seeing more and more and more of it out in public right now, what's key is not so much that label militia and whether they call themselves a militia. It's how are they acting? Are they coordinating the use of force or projection of the ability to use force? So are they armed? Are they coordinating their activities? So think of what you would expect the National Guard to do, right? They would deploy to predetermined or coordinated spots, like you take that corner, you take that corner, you take the roof. And that's the kind of thing that we often see with the militias. If you think about Kenosha recently, there were militia members at different corners of the streets in Kenosha and on the roof. They're coordinating with each other to undertake this use of force or projection of the ability to use force, usurping legitimate law enforcement authority, usurping, you know, legitimate military and state militia authority, and actually arrogating then to themselves where and under what circumstances they will deploy lethal force.
Now, tell me, have we seen much more of this kind of activity in the last, say, 4 years?
I think we've seen a lot more of it visibly out in public. So militias have been around, you know, really since the founding of the country. The modern militia movement dates to the 90s and was really exemplified by these major standoffs against the federal government. So think of Ruby Ridge, Idaho, and Waco, Texas. And in recent times, we've had the Bundy Ranch standoff out in Utah and the Muir Wildlife Refuge standoff in Oregon. These are sort of like anti-government militias who are protesting various government activities. And so what we've seen historically is militias would sort of ebb and flow depending in large part on who is in the White House, because they tend to have an anti-government, very pro-Second Amendment, pro-absolutist view of the Second Amendment agenda. And so they tend, when a Republican is in office, to be less active out on the streets. And when a Democrat is in office, like when Barack Obama was elected, they tend to worry and use this threat that the government's going to take their weapons as a rallying cry to be more active. Really strange about this current time is that we, of course, have a Republican who is president, but his ideology and his views line up with many of the militias, because most of the militias tend to be right-wing. There are some left-wing militias we can talk about, but the vast majority are right-wing militias. And so now, you know, President Trump himself had sort of an anti-government clean the swamp mantra, right, which these militias have, you know, embraced. He also has very much of an anti-immigrant ideology and a pro-Second Amendment ideology, which these groups have also embraced. And he's been very anti-fascist, if I can say it that way, you know, against those who are protesting for racial justice and against police brutality and other forms of racial inequities. And so now the militias have this common enemy that the president also views somewhat as an enemy. So they've coalesced in a very different way.
So, as I understand what you're saying, 50 states, in fact, prohibit individual militias from operating independently. It's only if the state authority, the governor, the president of the United States calls out the militia that they are legal. So, they are not legal anywhere. Is that correct?
That's right. So, and there's a variety of different state law provisions. 48 states actually in their constitutions require, and the term they use is military, they require the military in all cases to be strictly subordinate to and governed by the civil authority. These are constitutions written, you know, in ancient kind of language, 1700s, early 1800s. But the way that's been interpreted and the, what it meant at the time was, again, we want any military activity, militia activity, to be subordinate to the civilian government, the governor, not rogue militias, which of course made sense at the time. You know, they've just become states. We've been through a revolution. The last thing that the governors want to have to worry about are rogue militias that don't answer to them. The other type of provisions that 29 different states have is basically an anti-militia statute. And in most states, it's a criminal statute. These date back to Reconstruction. So again, you can imagine, you know, states are not wanting to deal with rogue militia elements. And these statutes prohibit bodies of men from associating together as military units or parading or drilling with firearms in public. And this statute was actually upheld by the Supreme Court in 1886 in a case called Presser v. Illinois against a challenge that statute violated First and Second Amendment rights. And that's the first time the Supreme Court said, no, 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 this is okay. Nothing about the Second Amendment prevents states from prohibiting private paramilitary organizations. More recently, in the 70s and 80s, another sort of set of anti-paramilitary activity statutes was passed, and 25 states have these statutes. And these statutes prohibit the activity, like the training, instructing, demonstrating, and even practicing together during an event in the use of firearms or techniques capable of causing bodily injury or death for use during or in furtherance of a civil disorder. So some combination of these, and some states have all of these, some combination every state has.
So now let's look at what's been happening more recently in both Wisconsin and Oregon. What kind of militia presence have we seen in those two states?
So in Wisconsin, particularly in Kenosha, we've seen most recently militias, unauthorized militias, deploy to the downtown area, ostensibly to protect private property, in response to what in most cases have been largely false rumors or false reporting over social media of, you know, quote unquote, violent anarchists coming to town or protesters bent on burning down, looting, rioting in our cities. You know, as people know, there have been incidences of looting and of rioting in cities during racial justice protests. But the vast majority, and I think sometimes this goes unreported because when nothing goes wrong, it doesn't always get reported, but the vast majority of protest activities, including in tiny little towns, are peaceful. So, but this call to arms goes out as it did in Kenosha, and the militias deploy, in that case, again, usurping the role of law enforcement. Now in Wisconsin, in addition to having a constitutional provision that, you know, bars rogue militias, they also have a statute that a number of other states have that prohibits people from falsely assuming the functions of a public official or a peace officer or a law enforcement. So in that case, and it doesn't mean you have to be saying you're a police officer and having a fake badge. It's just like falsely assuming those duties. So in the case of Kenosha, I mean, that's exactly what they were doing, right? They were themselves acting like they were law enforcement.
But the contradictory element there in Wisconsin is that they have open carry laws, correct?
They do. And in many states, they do. And I think that really adds to the confusion among even law enforcement, because you saw some law enforcement in Kenosha saying, well, they have a constitutional right to do this. I think that's part of the confusion. You put the Second Amendment together, people who don't understand it, with open carry, and they think that this is lawful. But the open carry in a state can't override what the Supreme Court has said about prohibiting private paramilitary activity. So it's one thing to open carry for your own individual protection that the Supreme Court has said is protected, but that says nothing about your ability to organize with groups of others carrying and organizing together.
So what is the responsibility of local law enforcement when they see these kinds of groups, militias, walking through the streets, carrying arms openly, and threatening people?
Well, I think law enforcement needs to become better informed about the laws in their own states and about the Second Amendment and how it's been interpreted by the Supreme Court. And then in some cases, they already are saying things to militias like, we don't need your help. We don't want your help. You have a right to come and express your you know, free speech rights peacefully, but we don't need your militia help. But they're not taking that next step of saying, and it would be unlawful under our state laws, and we're going to enforce that state law.
And why aren't they taking that second step?
Well, I do think a lot of it is because of this mythology about the Second Amendment, this really broadly and deeply held belief that particularly in an open carry state, that this is protected activity. You know, that's at best, right? At best, law enforcement is just misinformed. And it's a lot of people. It's beyond law enforcement. I'm not trying to cast aspersions on law enforcement. A lot of local officials, a lot of, you know, ordinary people on the street, if you ask them, they'd say, well, doesn't the Second Amendment protect it? So part of it, I think, is just not being informed about the law. And that's, you know, a great success of NRA and others who have really tried to push this view of the Second Amendment as being very absolute in ways that it's not. And then at worst, we have seen some law enforcement officials in some jurisdictions that do seem to be, you know, more complicit, more supportive in this type of behavior. I mean, we did see in Kenosha at least one or two who threw water bottles to the militias and said, we appreciate you all being here. Now, I don't know if that goes all the way up to the chief or if that was a few people out on the street. We also, of course, saw Kyle Rittenhouse walk right past a number of police, but could be they didn't realize he'd been the one
waving a rifle.
And we've seen other examples elsewhere. In fact, I've heard of examples in Louisville, for example, of the law enforcement, you know, kind of giving the thumbs up to the militias when they were there. There are sheriffs that consider themselves constitutional sheriffs. And by that, what they profess is that they are not actually answerable to any governmental authority. They're answerable to the Constitution as they interpret it. And they oftentimes are very supportive of private unauthorized militia activity. And so that's even a bigger problem. In fact, there are some instances where law enforcement, current or former, are actually members of some of these unlawful militias.
More of my conversation with Mary McCord when we come back. Here is the rest of my conversation with Mary McCord. She's legal director at the Institute for Constitutional Advocacy and Protection and visiting professor of law at Georgetown University Law Center. So from what the reporting tells us, are most of these militias white?
So the vast majority are white. They may not all be 100% white. Oftentimes they'll have, you know, one or two black people or a Latino person among their membership, but it's most common to be white men. There are some newly formed militias, one in particular, the NFAC, the Not Effing Around Coalition out of Georgia, which is a black militia. And, you know, they're fairly newly formed and they deployed to Louisville recently and they were there and the right wing 3%ers were there and the police were in riot gear in between them. So there really wasn't much First Amendment protected activity taking place there. But one can sort of understand why some of this more left wing groups might think, well, gosh, if these other people have been arming themselves and forming militias for decades and no one's paying attention, maybe we should do the same thing. So I sort of can't blame them for thinking that, but no matter what your ideology, it's unlawful, it's dangerous. I mean, that NFAC, three people were shot, not intentionally, but by accident when someone, I think, had a, you know, passed out from the heat and their weapon went off. But when you get that many, you know, big, long guns, AR-15s, with that many people, you're going to have those things happen. And then, of course, much worse, like in Kenosha, with the actual shooting and killing of two people, a shooting in Albuquerque that injured people, shootings in Portland. You know, you see how the escalation of the potential for violence is very real.
What about the rhetoric coming from Donald Trump? Is that in any way exacerbating this kind of activity all around?
Well, there's no question not only that he has not disavowed it or spoken out against it, but he has certainly, at least in a veiled way, if not more explicitly, condoned it. And that's not new with like Kenosha and Portland, where he's been vilifying the protesters as domestic terrorists and violent anarchists and said really nothing about the militias, including after the killings in Kenosha, but it dates back further. You know, in November of 2018, when he sent U.S. troops to the border, supposedly to supplement the work of the Customs and Border Patrol against the supposed caravan, the Latino caravan that was going to invade the Southwest border, you know, he makes noises about patriotism, et cetera. And the next thing you know, we had a bunch of militias deploying to the border. One, in fact, which then unlawfully detained migrants and held them until Customs and Border Patrol could take custody. Now, one of their members has since been arrested and convicted for falsely assuming the functions of a federal official. But that's rare that we've seen them. We've seen in October, I guess it was last October of 2019, when the impeachment proceedings were going on or the impeachment investigation was going on, and someone else tweeted about if there should be an impeachment and removal from office, this would be you know, turn into a civil war. The president retweeted that. And then the Oath Keepers immediately started tweeting and saying, we are ready, we are trained, we can, all you need to do is call us forth and we'll be there. And our weapon of choice is the AR-15. So, you know, it's not been explicit by the president, but it's been implicit, thinly veiled. And he uses words like patriots will do this and, you know, good people who care about their country would do that. And those are really dog whistles to the right-wing militias.
So what you're suggesting is that there is some kind of connection among these various groups.
So certainly many of these militias share some common ideologies. It's not identical across the board. There are some differences, but they share sort of an anti-deep state, anti-government, pro-Second Amendment view. And many, although they will claim outwardly that they are do not harbor white supremacist views, that they are not racist or misogynist or xenophobic, you often don't have to scratch very far below the surface to put the lie to that. So oftentimes on their own social media, either of their organization or of their individual members, you don't have to look pretty very far before you see some pretty blatantly racist and, you know, misogynistic, xenophobic memes and posts and other things like that. So again, I don't want to paint them all necessarily with that bad brush. I'm sure that there are some that are motivated by different things, but there's definitely a through line there of a pretty far right ideology.
So do they see themselves as aligned with the thinking and the rhetoric of Donald Trump?
Many certainly do right now. Obviously not so much the leftist ones and not so much the Boogaloo boys, which is a little bit of a different category we can talk about if you want. But the more traditional militias are finding themselves empowered because they do feel like Trump is supportive of them. So they feel more empowered to come out, I think, in public and take these public positions, including coming places where it defies logic why they'd be there. I mean, I've heard reporting multiple different states of them deploying to farmers markets, really just kind of because they can as a show of force, right? And things like that. So, and you know, we've seen them all over the country deploying to protect Confederate statues because there's a big push to bring these down now, protect other statues. In Albuquerque, it was a statue of a Spanish conquistador, and the New Mexico Civil Guard saw that it is their duty to go protect these statues. So they feel very emboldened, current political environment, to be able to engage in that.
You were going to talk about the others.
Yeah, so the Boogaloo boys, they do engage in militia activity. They are sort of an interesting ideology because they're more of an anarchist ideology, I think, than many of the traditional militias. So even though traditional militias will often be anti-government, it's really anti a certain kind of government because they oftentimes also align themselves with police. Like at many of their events, you'll see them carrying thin blue line flags and they appeal to former police and former military to become their members. So they're anti a certain form of government, but they're not really anarchists. The Boogaloo boys are more part of the movement of sort of accelerationist militias that are looking for maybe potentially to start a civil war. And in some of these groups, the most violent of them, like the Base, which is a new organization, which translate in Arabic to Al-Qaeda, which is a group that is trying to train and prepare for a civil war in the hopes of creating, you know, a white ethno state here in the United States.
Do you know where they are establishing themselves?
The thought there was to create a white ethno state in the Pacific Northwest, but some of the recent arrests of three members of the Base took place right in Delaware when they were planning. I don't know if you or your listeners recall, but in January of this year, there was something called Lobby Day in Richmond. So Virginia, for the first time, the previous election had gone blue, both houses of the state legislature. And the governor is Democrat, and there was a platform of bringing forth gun safety legislation, not banning guns, not getting rid of open carry, but gun safety legislation, including red flag laws, etc. So militias from all across the country convened on Richmond on January 20th for Lobby Day, so much so that the governor declared a state of emergency because of so much heavy weaponry. And these members of the Base who'd been training, they've got a training camp in Georgia, they'd acquired a machine gun, they had been staging in Delaware and training to come down to Lobby Day, take up sniper positions, pick off a few people and trigger a civil war. That was their plot and plan. The FBI, luckily, was on to that and made arrests just a couple of days before Lobby Day.
Wow. I mean, that's quite a story and putting all that together. But, you know, when you stamp out one spot, another jumps up. Is there any indication that identical efforts are being made in other parts of the country?
You know, we've seen Boogaloo Boys, some of them arrested for violent acts in various parts on the West Coast and in the Midwest. Recently, I think the FBI did arrest a couple of men who were traveling from Missouri up to Wisconsin. They were militia members that were planning to engage in violence there. So really, it's all over the country. What I'm hopeful about is I do think people are finally starting to actually, you know, pay a lot more attention to this activity. It's becoming so public. It's becoming so dangerous with now we've seen multiple shootings that state officials, local officials are starting to take heed. Certainly the FBI is doing more investigating and more arresting than we had seen in the past. The FBI, we know from Director Chris Wray, is worried about sort of domestic terrorism from white supremacy as the top threat. Again, I'm not trying to completely equivocate militias with white supremacy, but there's a very strong overlap there. And so we're seeing more attention paid to it. I will say also the Albuquerque district attorney, you know, has brought a civil lawsuit, and in full disclosure, my organization, I am co-counsel in that case with him, has brought a civil lawsuit against the New Mexico Civil Guard to seek an injunction that would prevent them from undertaking that type of militia activity in the future. What he saw there at the statute of this Spanish conquistador when they purported to defend it, and the result was there was a shooting and an injury. And you could say, why not just prosecute? But just prosecuting just, you know, ends up in punishing what already happened in the past. And what this is about is preventing it.
Exactly. Now, we recently learned of a whistleblower complaint directing Homeland Security to downplay the threat of white supremacy. How does that fit into everything we've been talking about?
That's very, very troubling for so many reasons. And, you know, ever since really for the last number of years, as we've seen the rise of domestic terrorist incidents really eclipse that of terrorism from international terrorist activities, such as Islamist extremist terrorism. We've seen that happen. You know, I come from a background at the Department of Justice for well over 20 years and was in national security there. And I saw it myself that the lethality of domestic terrorism, and by that we mean terrorism that's not motivated by a foreign terrorist organization like ISIS or Al-Qaeda, but something that is motivated by other domestic ideologies, most commonly in the U.S. white supremacy. The threat is really greater here than it is from Islamist extremist terrorism. Yet, to the public's mind, you know, until recently, terrorism was just like equated with 9/11, which was equated by Islamist extremism. And so, part of what, when I was in the Department of Justice and since I've been out of the Department of Justice, that I've tried to do is to educate people that, you know, terrorism doesn't depend on the ideology. It's a crime of violence done to intimidate or coerce a population, or influence the policy of government through intimidation or coercion. And that can be motivated by animal rights activism, white supremacy, Islamist extremism. Extremism, when it resorts to violence, is dangerous and it's terrorism. And so it's important for our governmental institutions, whether it's the Department of Justice, the FBI, the Department of Homeland Security, the White House, to be clear about what the threat is so that Americans understand what it is and can prepare for it and can combat it. And so when you see that being suppressed within DHS, put aside the politics of it for a minute and what kind of things motivated that, it's just dangerous because it gives people a false impression of what the threat picture in the U.S. is like.
And you just recently had a candidate elected in a primary who supports QAnon. That conspiracy is one that I think there is a lot of confusion about. Talk about QAnon and what it stands for.
There are others who have been studying QAnon for much longer and in much more depth than I have, but it is essentially a mass conspiracy theory that includes bizarre claims like government officials running, Democrats running, you know, child sex trafficking rings and all kinds of conspiracy theories that I almost hesitate to even repeat in a public forum like this, because they're so crazy. And so this is so dangerous because it has we see at some of these events where militias have showed up and where white supremacist groups have shown up and where we've seen clashes between white supremacists and counter-protesters or between racial justice protesters and white supremacist counter-protesters, we've often seen in the crowd these QAnon signs or QAnon banners or people who are adhering to the QAnon viewpoint. And it's a very anti-government viewpoint, and it's one that is conducive to violence and I think a real danger to our democracy.
Well, considering what you've been studying and working on for all these years, how does this make you feel about your own and our safety as a country, considering all these divisions that are sort of multiplying as we go?
It's troublesome, and it's interesting because I've had occasion in these last several years to really get to know a lot of people who have typically worked in international human rights, and they've typically monitored political violence internationally in countries that are really known for political violence, and they've all now started to turn their attention to the U.S., which is a position I never really expected the U.S. to be in, where we're worried about political violence right here at home. In the past, our institutions, I think, have been strong enough to protect against that. And even though people have had ideological differences in the U.S. ever since the U.S. was a country, we had a little bit more civility, I think, that has just gone by the wayside. I put some of that, the blame of that, also on social media. I think people are extremely emboldened to say not just mean, but violent things about others on social media. And they're not getting leadership that would condemn this. In fact, we are seeing, you know, the leader of this country often engage in really some of the worst online bullying. And that means everyone, the standard for everyone else just gets lowered along with that. And I don't want to suggest that, you know, one instance of online bullying means an act of violence, but I've seen this movie before. I've seen it, frankly, with international terrorism. A lot of things start online. They start through social media. Groups get in silos and they listen only to others who are like-minded. And pretty soon, you know, somebody here is willing to commit an attack on behalf of ISIS. Well, the same thing can take place when we're talking about ideologies like white supremacy. You listen to only those who have similar viewpoints. They get you spun up. You feel like because there's so much on social media that it's more mainstream than it really is, and that it has the imprimatur of like people who agree with it. You get a few tweets from the president that seem to support it. And then pretty soon somebody feels like they can just go out and take action with their weapon or with their vehicle. What we've seen recently in terms of the vehicle attacks is just shocking. This is what we were seeing from ISIS, in 2015, all over Western Europe. And here is just ISIS saying, use your vehicle, commit an attack. And now we're seeing it carried out right here at home.
Mary, I have one last question for you. If Donald Trump loses, what do you think happens with these groups who have been so, if I may be so bold as to use the word, inspired by his rhetoric? What happens the next day?
Part of the problem, Diane, is that right now there's so much seeding of the idea of mistrusting the results of the election. That's being seeded right now by the president and his own, you know, mouthpieces, suggesting mail-in balloting is subject to fraud, suggesting that if there's a delay in the count, that must be based on fraud. These are, I think, seeding that type of ideas that might motivate people to take action if they think that the election is not valid. And that's a very scary thought. And you're right, I'm not comfortable talking about it because I do have this fear of when you talk about things too much, they become self-fulfilling prophecies. I also don't want to scare any away from voting. This is such an important election. I don't want anybody to feel that they can't vote. You know, I hope that our institutions will be strong enough, including state and local. And that's part of the reason I'm glad that you're focusing on tension on this issue so that more state and local law enforcement, election officials, governors, will realize that militia activity, you know, that is not the way we operate in this country, because if the right-wing militias come out, we're probably going to see a rise of left-wing militias. And then we're in, you know, we're worse than the Wild West. And so, you know, we need people, regardless of your party affiliation, to recognize that this election will be done fairly, freely. There are procedures in place, lots and lots of smart election specialists and others working to make sure that votes are all counted and that the results are valid and believed by people to be valid. And so with that framework, and hopefully those from both parties condemning violence, I'm hopeful that we will not see the type of melees that, you know, we've seen in other countries sometimes.
Mary, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Diane.
That's Mary McCord, Legal Director at the Institute for Constitutional Advocacy and Protection and Visiting Professor of Law at Georgetown University Law Center. And that's all for today. Thanks to those of you who've reached out to let me know what you'd like me to cover during this very difficult time. Please continue to let us know what's on your mind. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsverka of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Thanks for listening, all. Please stay safe. I'm Diane Rehm.